When a tired and weary Menachem Begin announced his resignation as Prime Minister of Israel, he was succeeded by Yitzhak Shamir. Yitzhak Shamir is 69 years of age, and he joins that long list of older men and women who now occupy the most powerful offices in the major, or most of the major, countries of the world. Andropov in the Soviet Union, Reagan in our own country, Mitterrand in France, Indira Gandhi in India, Deng in China. I don't know quite what it means that the countries of the world, at least those where there is some kind of free expression of who shall lead, but it means that the national will is moving towards an older leadership. I suspect that it suggests that the world is tired of change, tired of those systemic shocks to the economic system, to the political system, to the system of morals by which people live, the social systems, which have been characteristic of the century. They somehow assume that older men will hold back the rate of change and allow the world to collect its wits, calm down. We need roots, and these roots seem to be challenged. Now, Israel's political system is a parliamentary system. And when a prime minister resigns, if he resigns after a vote of no confidence in the Knesset, new elections are called. If he resigns for personal reasons, the situation is not like that in the United States, where there is an arbitrary, predetermined schedule of succession. Gerald Ford followed Richard Nixon. But rather, the head of state, the titular head of state, in this case the president, Chaim Herzog, asks one or another of the leaders of the coalition which governs, or the major party, to see whether he or she can create a coalition which will gain a majority of votes in the Knesset. There are 120 seats in the Israel's parliament. A majority is 61. Obviously, any government would like to have a majority of a few more than 61. But it was necessary then to see whether or not there was any leader in Israel who could create a coalition government which would command a majority vote of approval, certification by the Knesset. Now, the Likud, the party of Menachem Begin, the party which has been largely in power in the last 6 years, has been in power because it was able to organize during the 8th and 9th and 10th, after the 8th and 9th and 10th Knesset elections, a coalition government, a government which commanded that necessary majority of seats. It is not itself the majority party in the Knesset. It does not command 61 votes. It has about 46 or 47 seats. Indeed, it is not the single largest party in the Knesset. The old Labor Party, which is now called the Alignment, has one more seat than Likud. Nevertheless, Herzog quickly determined that Labor would not be able to organize a government, even though he was tempted in that direction, so he himself comes out of the Labor Alignment. And he turned, as people knew he ultimately would have to Menachem Begin's party. Now, as you recall, Menachem Begin had announced that he would retire from office in late August. And he delayed submitting his actual letter of resignation for about 6 weeks. He did this purposefully in order to allow his party to meet and to nominate that person whom they wanted to head the new coalition. Yitzhak Shamir obviously was so nominated. But he was not nominated by acclamation. There was a vote. And the vote was between Shamir and a man, David Levy, a much younger man, 46 years of age. By all reports, the convention of the Likud was an amicable one. And certainly the old coalition, as far as Likud, remains in place. But the challenge of David Levy to Shamir's right to succession represents, in many ways symbolically, one of the major challenges which faces Yitzhak Shamir now that he is Prime Minister of Israel, and which will face any succeeding Prime Minister of Israel. For David Levy, is a son of what we call the Dot HaMizrahi, which is the other Israel, the Israel which comes out of North Africa, out of Egypt, out of Iran, out of Yemen, out of the so-called Oriental or Sephardic communities. He was born in Rabat, in Morocco. He came to Israel in the mid-1950s as part of the major exodus, the Aliyah of Moroccan Jewry, which took place during those years. And he represents the group which is now numerically the dominant group in Israel, but a group which has been looked down on and largely shunted aside by many of the old line political and cultural leaders of the country. Indeed, one of the major reasons for the defeat in the last two Knesset elections of Labor has been the fact that Labor has not known how to open its ranks to those Israelis from the Edot HaMizrahi, from the Arab countries, who bring an entirely different cultural background, a different set of attitudes to national politics and to the conduct of their own lives. Indeed, one of the ugliest features of Israel's cultural scene has been the development of what we would call in America Polish jokes, except they are Sephardi jokes. Jokes which put down a community which has not had the same kind of secular technical education as has the Western community now for several generations. A community which came in much poorer than even many of those who came in the Western Aliyah. A community which came in from an environment in which the extended family and the ties of the religious life had remained close and active and significant until the moment of Aliyah, unlike the European communities where for several generations in Eastern Europe, socialism with its secular ideology, industrialization, urbanization, had worked great changes in the ethos of the Jewish community. And so when Menachem Begin 6 years ago appointed David Levy as Minister of Housing, he would subsequently also get the appointment as one of the deputy prime ministers. All kinds of Polish jokes, in quotation marks, were passed about him. One, for instance, said, "Have you heard the latest David Levy story?" And the man to whom this is addressed said, "Well, I am David Levy." And the speaker then says, "Well, I'll tell it to you slowly." Well, David Levy turned out to be an energetic, effective, fairly charismatic minister of housing. He turned out to have a willingness to fight for his turf, and more importantly, to fight for people of his background, in which he was able from at times even to stand up to Menachem Begin and to say, "You must do this, you can't do that." And he's become the most attractive and influential of the leaders of the Edot HaMizrahi, man who has come closest to the senior office in the land. It's too early as yet to know what judgment history will make on Menachem Begin. But of this I'm certain, that he will go down with good marks in history, the history of Israel, for having been the first European political leader of consequence to have been able to listen to and to respond to and to, in a sense, share the concerns of the new majority of Israel, where the old line socialist labor leadership looks askance at religion, religious traditions, where they believe in freedom of the same kinds of personal freedoms of expression, which we tend to take for granted in the United States, where they tend to be romantically optimistic about the fact that people will shed their labels of religion, of tribe, of class, and be able to join together in common concerns, where they have created in their relationships to the Edota Mizrahi a self-fulfilling prophecy. They looked on these people as benighted because they did not share their set of values. They looked to them as religious fundamentalists simply because they tended to take their religious traditions with some degree of seriousness. They looked upon them as incapable of higher level jobs, administrative responsibilities, technical education, because they came to Israel with an education which had been parochial and, in a sense, medieval, limited to the classic texts. In 1970, Golda Meir, in a debate on the Eastern problem, said this in the Knesset, and is very typical of the attitudes of superiority and of insensitivity which marked the leadership of Israel, the leadership with whom you know and I know and whom we respect on so many other levels. Golda Meir said then in the Knesset, many immigrants from the Islamic countries brought deprivation and discrimination with them in their baggage. The Jews who came to us from the Oriental countries were of a higher level than the population from which they came. But it was their fate to live in countries that have not yet developed intellectually, industrially, or culturally. And they were deprived of the opportunity to develop their special characteristics, to enlarge their intellectual capacities, and to acquire the knowledge and education that were given to those coming from the developed countries of Europe and America. We know, they don't know, our values are right, their values are benighted, only in measure as they become WASPs, as they become part of the founding ethos, can we adjust to them and accept them into the body politic. And in point of fact, many of the commentators from with European backgrounds, the more ideological among them, many of them have bemoaned the fact that the Edot HaMizrahi now represents the majority of Israel. What will become of the ideology, the Zionist ideology, which founded and nurtured the state? Menachem Begin knew that a state is people, and that people from many cultures bring different insights, and these insights often have value to them, that all knowledge, the truth, did not rest with the particular ideology of the founding fathers. And he reached out to men like David Levy, and he brought them into the government. And he bound many of the Edot HaMizrahi to him and to his party, and to a very large degree, the strength of Likud has rested upon this marriage of two cultures, this marriage which Begin undertook. Now, Shamir will be charged with continuing the work that Begin began, and it is not an easy undertaking. For not only is there this sense of superiority among the founding fathers, but there is also among the Edot HaMizrahi many signs of that tragic kind of cultural and personal dislocation which occurs when people from one culture are suddenly thrust into another culture which does not support or encourage the values which are theirs. In Israel, the Edot HaMizrahi found themselves in a culture which to a very large degree was determinedly secular, which did not encourage the bonds of the extended family, which demanded that the children be educated in ways which the parents did not understand. And it created any number of dislocations on a personal level within the family. And because many of these people came in semi-literate, came in impoverished, came in with limited skills, all of these problems had to be faced by people who often lacked the wherewithal to meet the ongoing daily responsibilities of survival. And so there has developed among the Edot HaMizrahi an underclass, an underground, an underworld. Much of the crime in Israel, drug problem in Israel, comes out of that world. And that's why I spoke of it as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Having looked down askance upon this culture, in a sense, the first Israel has created the situation which has allowed this underworld Israel to develop, a world which is angry, a world which is very much like the world of the underclasses in the United States. There are significant social problems. The two worlds in Israel must become one. And that challenge, obviously, is one which Shamir must face and which any succeeding prime minister must face. Having won the assent of his own party, the consent of his own party to form a government, did not assure Shamir of the prime ministership. He had now to gain the assent of the minority parties who form the governing coalition. And this is a complicated process. There are any number of parties which have one vote or two vote in the Knesset. Enough of these had to be bound to the coalition in order to get the 61, 62, 63 votes needed to ensure power. Now, the major group among these minority parties are the religious parties, and they are two, essentially. The National Religious Party, which now represents European Orthodoxy, and Tami, the Sephardic, the Oriental Religious Party, which is a breakoff from the European-dominated religious group, again on the very same grounds of the other Israel, which we've been talking about. These parties suffered electorally during the last election. Their number of seats was almost cut in half. They control only seven seats between them. But these seven seats are crucial to anyone who would form a government. And so Shamir had to enter into negotiations with the religious parties. And these negotiations have been typical of every government since the founding of the state. They are the force under which led Ben-Gurion to give the religious group control over the laws of personal property. Later, prime ministers gave to this group preferential treatment in terms of money for their educational institutions. Menachem Begin, when he first came to power, agreed with this group that he would open up the whole question of the law of return to see whether or not they could amend it so that those who had been converted in the diaspora by such ignorant and incompetent rabbis as myself would not be welcomed into Israel under that particular law. It was increasingly the Orthodox have demanded that the actions by the non-Orthodox groups outside of Israel and in Israel be restricted and be held to have no validity. In recent years, the religious bloc has become increasingly under the control of its most extreme fringe. And one of the problems which exists in Israel today is that the religious divisions which have always been there have been exacerbated by a group known as the Haredim, those who are the fanatic, those who claim that they fear God. The Haredim have, in a sense, dominated the Orthodoxy by taking Orthodoxy into the streets. They have been opposed by many of the finest spiritual leaders of Israeli Orthodox traditionalism. But nevertheless, by their actions, by their determinations, they have confronted authority with a number of challenges. In those areas in Jerusalem in which they live, they have begun to take direct action against the lo dati, against anyone who is not Orthodox who happens to live in or near the same area. The apartments of the non-Orthodox who live in these areas have been burglarized, have been ransacked, and in some cases have been set on fire. They have taken to regular stoning of certain areas, certain roads which pass near their quarters. They were involved, some of them, in the attempt to take over the Temple Mount, which would have created, a few months ago, which would have created a terrible international furor. They threw rocks during the last municipal election and glass at Teddy Kollek, the mayor of Jerusalem. and bruised him rather severely so that he was walking for several weeks with a cane. Their issue? The fact that the municipality of Jerusalem was building a swimming pool in an area not in but close to one of the Orthodox communities, and their concern is that they look upon mixed bathing as scandalous and unacceptable. A number of the graves of archaeologists on the Mount of Olives were desecrated several months ago by the Haggadim because archaeologists in Israel were excavating in the area which is called Kiryat David, the old city of David. It's south of the present walls of Jerusalem. And they claimed there, their claim has no basis in fact, that there was a graveyard there, a Jewish graveyard, and the bones of the Jewish dead would be desecrated. They went in some months ago into the great necropolis of Beit Shearim, one of the beauty spots and the tourist attraction of Israel, and created vandalism of the worst kind. So that the issue of how far you go to pacify the religious groups, how much you give in order to bring them into a government, and how much those who are the senior leaders of the religious party can do to limit the more fanatic of their followers is a complicated kind of negotiation. We are not sure what Shamir agreed to do. He apparently agreed to maintain the restrictions on El Al, as far as it's not flying on the Sabbath. He apparently agreed to see what could be done to limit the transportation system, the Egged buses, and movement on the Sabbath. He apparently agreed to do what he could with the municipality in Jerusalem to delay the construction of this swimming pool. But that whole issue has not yet surfaced in the press. But all we do know is that the religious bloc of seven votes agreed to vote with Menachem Begin, with Shamir, as they had with Begin. Now, here we have the second of the major problems which confront Shamir and will confront any and every subsequent Israeli prime minister. It's the issue of the nature of a Jewish state. In what sense is Israel a Jewish state? To what degree? Does the fact that Israel is a Jewish state mean that orthodoxy is to be the church state? That it is to be the dominant, the controlling element as far as religious practice, laws of personal status, determining the content of the educational curriculum, and so on? A majority in Israel apparently do not want that to happen. But the electoral system is such that the religious power parties have an inordinate power. And the Edot HaMizrahi, the Eastern groups, bring to Israel not the kind of fanatic orthodoxy that the Hasidim and other Ashkenazic groups bring to Israel, but a general respect for matters religious, the kind of respect we rarely see in the West in our Jewish communities. And they do want Israel to have a strongly religious flavor. It's not yet quite defined what that flavor will be. And so Shamir must somehow walk the line between the pressure of the fanatics, the pressure of the extreme secularists, the desire of the Edot HaMizrahi for a further religionization of the state. And at the same time, he has the problem that this particular issue raises of his relationships with the Jews of diaspora. In the diaspora, orthodoxy is a minority of a minority. Here, the dominant groups in terms of our communities, in terms of our national Jewish organizations, are non-Orthodox. They are either non-affiliated or conservative or Reform. There is great frustration in the diaspora about the restrictions placed upon other kinds of religious expressions other than those of the Orthodox community in Israel. And Shamir is going to have to walk a very careful road in his dealings with the Orthodox so that he does not alienate the non-Orthodox Jews of the diaspora so much that the funding on which Israel depends, the monies which come through the UGA and other sources, do not dry up, and the political support for which they must turn to us again and again does not begin to diminish. The religious problem is a knotty problem. It's a problem whose real terms, we're just beginning to re-examine. But it's one which Shamir must face, which Israel must face, and we must face to a certain degree with them. Now, Shamir's having won the smaller groups into the coalition, Shamir's problems were not yet over. He thought he had a coalition. And then six members of the coalition, six members of Likud, who come from what was known originally as a liberal party in Israel, who were the non-revisionists, who were essentially free enterprise urban types who had joined together since the early days of the state, the equivalent of the Zionist Organization of America in the United States. Six members of this liberal group within the Likud said, "We will not vote with you to form a coalition until you make a serious attempt to create a government of which is a national coalition of all parties. The issues which we face are too grave for any one party to rule. And so many of the problems which we face exist because no government has had the support of a sufficient number in the Knesset to push through the kinds of difficult decisions which our economy and our society require." Now, as you know, because it's been well publicized, Israel has been troubled by the decision to go into Lebanon and the consequences of the Lebanese incursion. The Peace Now movement drew tens of thousands to its various meetings and protests. There is a group in Israel called Yesh Gavul. There is a limit. It consists of now of a few hundred military reservists who say, "We will fight in Israel's wars, we will do our military duty, but we will not cross the border into Lebanon. We will not do our duty in Lebanon because we consider that war to be un-Zionist, un-Jewish." There has been, in other words, a sizable and serious protest against the decisions which were involved in the summer of 1982, decisions of Begin and Sharon during those days. And obviously, the country needs to knit itself together in order to meet the serious challenges of this day. But that was not the major issue in the minds of these six ministers. Their major concerns had to do with Israel's economy. Everyone has known for a long time what needs to be done to bring the economy into line. But no group has had the political clout or the political will or been willing to play the political cost of doing it. Israel, as you know, has over the last 4 or 5 years endured triple-digit inflation. And the Israeli government has continued to print money with great abandon, and it has pegged the Israeli pound at a value which far exceeds its real value. There have been monthly devaluations, but they have not been, for the most part, at a level which was equivalent to the actual value devaluation of that money. The international monetary groups, a few months ago, spoke out in great concern about the size of Israel's foreign debt, the size of its trade imbalance. And many in Israel are concerned that Israel may be locked out, as other developing countries, from the international monetary markets and may have its development, therefore, retarded. Figures have been published recently which indicate that by the end of this year, for this year alone, Israel's trade deficit will be $5.5 billion, which is equivalent to 20% of its gross national product, and that its entire foreign debt will be on the order of $23.5 billion. Now, to put that into terms which have some meaning to us in a country where we toss around billions of dollars, you know, in our financial debates with rare abandon, let me say to you this, that if we compare the economy of Israel in terms of its total size with the economy of Brazil, and we've heard so much about Brazil's economic problems, the debt of Israel is three times the size of the debt of Brazil, given the comparative size of their economies. Israel's debt is now something on the order of $5,500 or $600 for every man, woman, and child. Now, what's to be done has long been known. Israel has to tighten its belt, it has to cut its expenses, it has to find new industries and develop new industries to supplant those which are no longer as profitable as they once were. The diamond industry, on which Israel depended for so much of its foreign currency has fallen on hard times. Once Spain was taken into the common market, Spanish flowers and oranges were able to move into the markets of Europe both faster and more cheaply than were Israeli goods. The Israeli economy has been based upon a Zionist ideology of full employment, which means that there is a swollen bureaucracy, which means that productivity is low, that there are too many hands doing what one person could do much more efficiently, which has meant also that most in Israel have not one job but two jobs. And the second job is also part of what is called the black economy, the economy of cash, the economy which is not reported and therefore is not subject to taxes. And this economy needs to be brought under some kind of control. It has to make its contribution to the society. Israel's economy grew in real terms with great strength through the 1950s and the 1960s. But with the 1970s, Israel began to feel that it had arrived, that it could afford everything that the West, the great industrial countries of the West, could afford. And particularly the upper classes in Israel began to live with a largesse, a love of luxury, which belies the fact that Israel is still an underdeveloped country, really part of the third world. If you want to buy an apartment in Jerusalem or in Mount Carmel, you'll pay a cost in real dollars equivalent to the cost of an apartment in Midtown Manhattan. The wealthy upper groups in Israel have been speculating on their stock market just as rich Americans have been speculating in ours. And the stock market has spiraled up and up. There's been all kinds of monopoly money out there in the economy to buy the luxury goods, to buy the apartments. And no stocks had pyramided more dramatically than the bank stocks, which were looked upon as the blue chips. Since 1980, these bank stocks on average have increased in value in real dollars, not in Israeli pounds, by 200%. And so, this summer, when people realized that this kind of economic folly had to come to an end, and that any government would have to take stringent measures to bring the economy into line, to cut expenses, to raise taxes, to do all the things we hear from Washington and from London and from all the other capitals of the world, that Israel couldn't keep living on handouts from American Jews and on foreign aid from the American government. It would have to really take its own economy in hand. There began to be a run on the bank stocks as Israelis, recognizing that a serious devaluation of the pound was at hand, began to convert pounds into dollars as fast as they could. The run got to the point in early September that the new government had to close the Israeli stock market for 2 weeks. The Israelis, in a very short time, had converted something well over $150 million worth of pounds into dollars, and they had secreted these in their mattresses outside the normal systems of government, gambling on the fact that the pound would fall and that if they bought in again, they would have made a great deal of money in that kind of activity. Well, that kind of activity threatened the survival of the banks of Israel, the whole financial system of Israel, at the very time that the international monetary groups were saying, we're not sure that Israel's economy is sound enough for us to continue lending to Israel to meet Israel's development needs. The government clearly had to take the economic issue seriously. And almost immediately after the run on the stock, on the bank stocks, the closing of the stock market, the old finance minister of the Begin government, who had reappointed to the Shamir government, a man named Aridor, announced a plan to what they called dollarize the Israeli economy. And by that he meant that all contracts, wage, purchase contracts and the like, would be quoted in terms of dollars, not in terms of Israel pounds. And that the value of the dollar, the strong American dollar, would determine the value of any agreement entered into within the Israeli economy. That meant, in essence, that the government was giving up its ability to print money, its ability to live beyond its means. And there was a hue and cry about giving up one's sovereignty, about Israel becoming a puppet of the United States. Maridor had not done his political homework. He allowed this plan to leak into the press without having talked, apparently, with his fellow ministers, and he was quickly forced to resign. It was too radical an approach. But the concerns which were raised by the Maridor plan remained valid. Some means has to be found to force the political, those in political leadership in Israel to disconnect the economy from their whim, from their desire to always give people everything they want. The Israeli economy has been able to adjust to triple-digit inflation because there's automatic cost of living adjustment. Every month, your salary changes. Every time you go to the supermarket, you'll find a different price on bread and on milk and on all the other goods. And it's simply each month, your salary went up as prices went up. But the mathematical mechanism meant, in fact, that your wages went up a little faster than the prices went up. And when the major labor unions demanded not only this automatic cost of living adjustment, but major increases in their wages, by and large, they were able to impose their will upon a very welfare-structured society. And so whether it was the doctors last summer or the teachers 4 years ago or the government workers a year ago, these unions won for their members 30-40% increases in real wages at a time when Israel could not afford, in many cases, the wages that were already being paid. What Maridor was trying to do was to disconnect the automatic indicization of all parts of the Israeli economy, to force Israelis to recognize to what degree they were living beyond their means, to what degree the government simply printing paper, giving that paper an arbitrary value, and creating a false economy, a pyramided kind of economy, which had to ultimately collapse. Well, he was discharged. And the new finance minister said, I don't believe in dollarization, and then has proceeded to try and effect the very changes which Maridor was concerned with, but in a more systematic, less simple kind of way. He has spoken of the need to cut government expenses. For the first time, there is a serious debate in Israel as to whether the amount of money which is spent for defense can, in fact, be cut. Social services will have to be cut. There will have to be cut in one's real wages, a lowering of the standard of living. He wants to increase the level of taxation at the highest levels of the society, a very good idea. He wants to increase the effectiveness of their Internal Revenue Service over the black economy. He wants to destroy the automatic linkage between wages and prices so that wages fall relative to prices. And so the Israelis are discouraged from buying the luxury goods. The fastest selling item in Israel this last year and a half has been color television. Now, Israel does not transmit color television. The only time that your color television can be useful is if you also bought expensive tapes, which are in color. The Israeli government, the cameras of the television company of Israel are color television cameras. But the Israeli government requires that their broadcasting stations take away the color because they were trying to dampen the desire for these far more expensive sets. Nevertheless, people ran out in droves to buy these sets, to buy the big cars for Israel's narrow roads and the short distances that have to be traveled. And their reason was a self-serving one. The pound had little value. It was losing value all the time. Goods supposedly have real value. It was better to have your wealth in goods than it was to have your wealth in dollars, in pounds, or in paper. They're very much interesting. Here were Ashkenazic Jews acting exactly like Arabs. You go to an Arab market, what do you see? You see these small, thin gold bracelets. They're really simply bracelets made out of gold, which the woman will carry with her from elbow to wrist. They are the movable property, the real property of the family. They don't trust the banks. They've never trusted the currency of the Arab world. And so, like the French, The Arabs have been trained to carry their money with them. And now the Israelis have put their money into the luxury items in their apartments and in their homes. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy which cannot for long continue. And it's the third of the major problems which Shamir and his government face, and which every succeeding government of Israel must face. One of the great tragedies of Israel is that the Israelis have looked on us and have tried to say, to live by the standards which we, in the most powerful and one of the most affluent countries in the world, have been able to accept. And when we go to Israel, we encourage that kind of thing among our families. If they don't have a television set, we send them one. How can you not have a new car? Why do you have such a small apartment? And the American Jews who and British Jews and South African Jews who go to Israel and bring their money in with them have established an upper class who live by Western standards, which are so far beyond the standards of the development towns, of the other Israel, of the average Israeli, that for the first time, serious class divisions have developed in the society. And all kinds of financial shenanigans occur, which ought not to occur. Now, Israel's economy is not in tatters. A good bit of industrial and technological development has taken place. Israel's aviation industry is one of the model industries of the world and one of the most profitable in the country. Israel has skills, and certainly has if these human resources are applied intelligently in the medical fields, in the technical fields, in the fields of drugs, in the fields of all kinds of high-skilled activity, could compete effectively in the world. But productivity must be increased. Obviously, there has to be some kind of cutting down of a bloated bureaucracy. Israel is the, if you consider Israel as one of the industrialized countries of the world, Israel has the smallest percentage of its people involved in industry of any of those countries. Less than one in three in Israel is involved in the production of goods or of agricultural products. Of the rest, half are government employees. And when the mayor of Tel Aviv tried 2 years ago to diminish by attrition about 5,000 jobs from his establishment, he had a citywide strike on his hands. This is the third of the areas which Shamir must face. He must find a way to give, to reduce the deficit in foreign reserves, to reduce the international debt, to increase Israel's ability to compete in international markets, in other words, to create a sound and substantial economy. I believe he has the human resource with which to do this, but he's going to have a political courage, which as yet no Israeli prime minister has shown. Now, what of Yitzhak Shamir himself? What of the man? Does his past suggest that he will have the strength to accomplish these goals? Shamir, as you know, was born in Poland. He was a law student in Warsaw, a member of the youth movement of the revisionist party, Jabotinsky's party, when in 1935 he made Aliyah to Israel. In Israel, he joined first the Irgun, and then he joined this much smaller and much more radical Lehi, what became known by the British as the Stern Gang, after the leader Avram Stern, the people responsible for the assassination of the High Commissioner Lloyd Moyne in Cairo in 1942, people who were somehow also associated with the assassination of Count Bernadotte in 1946. Twice Shamir was imprisoned, twice he escaped. He ended by being one, after Stern's death, by being one of the triumvirate of men who governed the actions of the Stern Gang. He's obviously a man of courage, a man of determination, a man who is willing to put his life on the line. After the war, he returned from France, where he'd hidden for the several years, and he led a largely private life, although he has seems to have spent some time in the Mossad Israel's intelligence system. In 1965, he left various government jobs and he went into private industry for a few years. In 1970, he entered politics with a sheepdog who was willing to do what his seniors told him to do and did it well. He was appointed in the Ninth Knesset to be the Speaker of the House, which is usually a dead-end kind of job, but he went from that to becoming Menachem Begin's foreign minister. He's known, in other words, he's well-liked. He's known as a hard-working man. He's obviously a man committed to Israel and to Israel's survival with heart and soul and might. But he's also known as a man who has never in the past shown his willingness to innovate, to break new ground. He's a follower rather than a leader. And what gives us the most hope, I would guess, is that he has this reputation as one of undaunted courage, a fighter, who if he becomes a bulldog, was willing to dig in his heels and stand his ground if that ground needs to be stood. And particularly in the very difficult world minefield of the economy, certainly somebody of courage is desperately needed. I've spoken of the domestic problems that Shamir faces. The others you all know, they're documented daily in the press. And I concentrate upon these domestic issues because I'm increasingly convinced that though the questions of war and peace are ultimately faced on the level of political and military decisions, ultimately those decisions are made by the various countries on the basis of other reasons. The real causes of peace in our world or war in our world of tension have to do with poverty and wealth and their distribution. They have to do with population and overpopulation. They have to do with the distribution or maldistribution of economic resources and natural resources. They have to do with the numbers of people in any given society who are capable of creating the technological and administrative infrastructure that a society needs, or the lack of that, of sufficient numbers to accomplish these ends. Ultimately, Israel can meet each and every international challenge. But if she fails to resolve the economic problem, she fails to weld a single unified Israel, she fails to resolve what it means to be a Jewish state, ultimately she will be weakened and a weak Israel will ultimately not survive. So these are the questions, these are the issues, in my mind, the priority issues which face Yitzhak Shamir. They are the issues, priority issues, which face the whole Jewish community. Because ultimately, Israel has now put herself in a position where she depends to a very large degree for economic survival on the United States. And not simply on the UJA, but most especially on the government of these United States. The $2.5 billion which the United States now annually gives in foreign and military aid are the difference for Israel between her having an opportunity to bring her house in order and Chapter 11. Bankruptcy. And it is becoming increasingly difficult, given our own straitened economic situation, to see to it that these levels of money are continually available from our own government to the support of Israel. The time frame is not as long as many in Israel believe it to be. I'm not convinced that we can be confident that year in and year out, whatever government is in power in the United States, major sums of money will be available for Israel's own uses. Ultimately, if Israel wants to be independent and to follow an independent foreign policy, she must be financially sound. Her people must be united. The area of economic and financial soundness, the area of a united, determined people, these are the areas in which I hope Yitzhak Shamir will concentrate his efforts and, God willing, be successful. Amen.